I think we have a quorum, and if anybody has had a chance to look at the minutes.
Madam Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Representative Pearson moves the minutes of March 27th. Any changes or corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, minutes are approved. Members, we have several groups with us today to again remind us of what brings us here and what motivates us to work hard on this issue. We are joined by, first, the Wilder Foundation. So if you would... you're switching the order. Okay. So it's Minnesota Housing Partnership, Ann Navity, who is going to kick us off. And welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you so much. We'll just get this slide deck teed up.
No. Is there a disadvantage?
Thank you.
I think where they come.
So my name is Ann Mavity, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership. We are a 30-year-old statewide organization. Most of you are probably familiar with us and our work and our staff. We work in three areas in order to help drive investments and smart strategic policies to preserve and create affordable housing, especially for those at the greatest need. And we work in three areas. One of those is working directly with local communities, particularly rural communities and Native communities throughout Minnesota, to help communities identify their own housing needs. And then we work with them to actually implement strategies to help create that housing locally. We also do policy and advocacy, such as coming before this committee and driving policy solutions that, again, will help create and preserve affordable housing, especially for those with the greatest need. And then finally, and what I'll talk with you about today, is we do original research. And to help formulate and inform the policy conversation around affordable housing in the community and really to put information into the hands of folks like you to make good, sound decisions, but also information in the hands of residents throughout Minnesota so that they have the facts and figures about housing and it helps let them tell their own story because everyone has a story about housing in Minnesota. So... the first thing I want to talk about, we'll go back one. The first thing I want to talk about is of the publications that we do, Market Watch is one of the more recent ones where we've been focusing on naturally occurring affordable housing. We have three reports out on that so far that are focused on Minneapolis, on St. Paul, and separately on Dakota County, and we're working on an additional one. Out of Reach tracks the growing gaps between wages and rent across Minnesota, and then we'd also produce legislative district profiles, and hopefully you all will get one, and these are specific to your own district. So what I'll be talking about today is general information about housing throughout Minnesota, but these legislative district profiles tell you what's happening right in your backyard. So the next, what I want to talk about today then, is the state of the state of housing report that we've done. We started this 2 years ago to really compile all the information that we know about housing in a compelling way, again, that makes it accessible and summarizes what our housing challenges are in Minnesota. In this report, which is a 70-page report, and if you would like, we can get you all individual copies. You can download it from our website as well. But in this report, there's a state overview. There's a state profile on housing. We also conduct regional analyses for parts of the state around the region. We'll touch on that at the end. We do county profiles, so you can see how your counties and your districts compare with other counties throughout Minnesota, and rankings and maps. So if you go on our website, you can download the full report, or upon request, Libby Murphy, our chief lobbyist here, she'll be able to get one for you as well. So as we talk about affordable housing, I just want to make sure we all have the same terms that we're talking about. So what is affordable? Basically, as most of you know, affordable means that you're spending no more than 30% of your income on your housing needs. Because what we have found over decades is that people who spend more than 30% of their income are making some really hard choices about not spending money on transportation, on health care, on other kinds of food, other kinds of essential needs, and all of that leads to more instability. So spending 30% of your income is the general benchmark by which we feel that folks can have stable housing and maintain it. A lot of what we'll talk about in this report is about cost burdens. And so cost burdens means if you're paying more than that, right? If you're paying more than 30% of your housing, then you are cost burdened. And we talk about severe cost burdens when we say folks are spending more than half of their income on housing. Another term you'll get throughout this report is extremely low income households. And again, as you know, we talk a lot about the area median income. And the area median income, when we say if it's 30% or less of the area median income, that's what we refer to as extremely low income. And clearly those households have less ability to secure affordable housing and less money to spend on housing. The area median income will obviously change by region. In the Twin Cities, it's at about 94,000, and that means that's sort of the halfway point between half the households make more than that and half make less of that. So these are the terms we'll use throughout this report. So in summary, and actually I'm just going to go through these one by one. So the first thing I want to talk about is the overall cost burden. In Minnesota today, more than 500,000 households pay more than they can for housing. And that, again, what that means is that one out of every four households in Minnesota is cost burdened and making these hard choices. Furthermore, we know that in housing, racial disparities persist. And so what we're seeing on the cost burden is that while 23% of white households are paying more than they can afford, that rises to 40% of households of people of color and households of color. So we know that there are racial disparities within housing. And when we look at what our competitive advantage is in the region, I also want to note that Minnesota is not comparing so well with our neighboring states in the region. So the percentage of renter households and owner households that are cost burdened in Minnesota is actually higher than those within our surrounding states. So Minnesotans are paying more for their housing than other communities.
Ms. Bethany, we have a question to this issue.
Yes,
I think,
please.
Kirsten.
And I just want to get it on the record. At the point where you were just talking about the use of the, if you go back to the last one more slide, when we were talking about the median income use and the economic.
Yes.
Yeah, oh, there you go. So we're talking about disparities in this committee a lot, and I really appreciate that, and that's actually why I'm sorry to interrupt your presentation.
No, please.
You're doing a great job. I just want to do it while it's timely. When we talk about certain communities in the state of Minnesota, I feel like the calculus gets shifted a little bit because we talk about a median calculation, and there are certain areas in our state where maybe we have extremely high incomes. And when you use that median income, then that actually brings up that threshold number for how your calculation mathematically works out, rather than an average income or other calculations of that. And I guess especially as it pertains to the disparities,
mm-hmm.
Is the median income the best calculation to use? And again, I don't mean to put you on the spot today. Oh. I'm asking the question in the context of just having a conversation, and I don't expect mm-hmm. an answer on the spot at all right now, but I kind of just want to open that thought process up of saying, is this the best calculation? You know, I represent the communities in Olmsted County, mm-hmm. including Rochester, where we could have somebody on an extremely
sure.
low threshold of income, but then we could have some folks that are, a larger than average population of
sure.
folks that are in the extremely high income sets. And so when you do the median calculation of those subsets, are we always giving the same balanced, fair approach,
sure,
especially as it pertains to your extremely low income household calculations?
Ms. Mavity.
Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. What I would say is that area median income is a national standard that HUD uses to estimate housing costs and to talk about housing costs. So in the housing world, it is the benchmark and the measurement that's used. And you are correct that it is not always the best tool for teasing out some of the local differences in housing. For example, in our Market Watch report we recently finished for St. Paul, where we are looking at naturally occurring affordable housing, the city of St. Paul's median income is substantially lower than the area median income for the Twin Cities. And so doing that research, we actually used the median income for St. Paul instead of for the whole Twin Cities, in order to tease out some of those differences. So I would say it is absolutely the standard within the housing world to talk about this, and digging deeper, you can sometimes tell a more nuanced story looking at the kinds of differences that you're talking about. I will say that it does impact the overall housing market for each of these markets. So if the area median income is quite high and many folks have more to spend on housing, they are often, and the vacancy rate is quite low, it does mean that those higher income households are often eating up the housing supply that would otherwise be accessible to those at the lower income.
Please continue.
Thank you.
So one of the trends that we have seen over the last 7 years in this report is really looking at a growing gap that is pointing to a trend that's going in the wrong direction. So that income versus housing costs, when we're looking at housing costs for both homeowners and for renters, housing costs are accelerating at a much higher rate, where income is either staying about steady or decreasing. So for homeowners, while the home value has increased 15%, the median homeowner income has only increased 3%. So that gap in your ability to continue to pay your housing costs is growing. And for renters, it's worse, where the gross rent increase is about 13% over this time frame. This renter income has decreased 5%. And I will note that this is already controlled for inflation. That kind of trend over time has meant that we have this market mismatch of what the market's producing versus what's actually accessible and available and affordable to the lowest income households. So when we look at extremely low income households, again, those at that 30% area median income and below, there's about 179,000 households in Minnesota at that income level. And yet, there's only 68,000 affordable and accessible units of housing available to them, which leaves a 111,000 unit gap at that very lowest income. So while in Minnesota, we need all kinds of housing everywhere across all incomes in order to manage our growth, we are also falling dramatically behind for those at the very lowest income. One of the key tools to address affordable housing is to help folks pay that rent, to pay that differential. And in Minnesota, we have almost 90,000 rental assistance available to households to do that. Most of those are through federal rental assistance. However, there's a 22-month waiting list to get that. And we know that sometimes folks, once they're actually make it to the top of a wait list and take their voucher and go out to try to find housing, landlords either will not accept that housing or there's simply not housing to rent that's available. And what I will say is this. Rental assistance, even though of the folks that are eligible for rental assistance, only one out of four people that are eligible, or households that are eligible for rental assistance, actually are able to receive it, because there are budget caps to what's available to spend on rental assistance. That's in contrast, surprisingly, for homeowners. So I'm a homeowner. I get that homeowner mortgage interest deduction on my taxes. And anyone who's eligible for that gets it. Everyone who's eligible gets it. And we actually spend a lot more money on that. There's no caps to that. So there is caps for those at the very lowest income who are trying to pay their housing. There's no caps for homeowners who are trying to claim that home mortgage interest deduction. So one of the things that this report does is looks at affordability by occupation. So there are a number of the most the jobs and occupations that are growing in this state and projected to grow even more. What we're seeing are personal care aides and home health care aides are the kinds of jobs that are going to be most in demand. And we'll talk about this in a second, largely because we have a growing population, an aging population, and that needs this kinds of assistance. And yet, amongst these growing jobs, there's very few that are actually, you can be working full-time and still not be able to afford an average apartment. So hardworking folks are struggling mightily to do that. That is true throughout every county in Minnesota, and it's true, frankly, throughout the United States as well. So we know that even though these jobs are growing and in high demand, they're still not enough to pay the rent. Now, among home ownership, again, one of the key factors that Minnesota unfortunately continues to be a leader in is some of the racial disparities in home ownership. We have about a 77% home ownership rate among white households, but when you look at our black households, that home ownership rate drops to 24%. It's part of why you see in Minnesota Housing and some other home ownership strategies a real focus on ensuring that households of color have access to home ownership as well. So we are seeing a number of demographic shifts that, again, will be impacting the kind of housing demands that we will be seeing around the corner. One of those is that we are growing. Our population will continue to grow. And if we want to continue to be hold our competitive edge regionally and nationally, we need to respond to that growth. And people of color and households of color will also continue to be a growing percentage of our population. So if we know that racial disparities in housing are a result of intentional policies and strategies that have happened over time, and so we also know that we have an ability, and all of you have an ability, to change those policies to turn the trajectory of those trends on racial disparities. So the last data point that I just want to talk about is looking at our growth in our senior population. So we will have this is no surprise, I'm sure, to any of you that people talk about this as a silver tsunami that's coming. We are an aging population, and the growth in senior households will be striking, and that will demand a housing supply that will speak to that population as well. And one of the challenges is that these households do not have the kinds of income and assets needed to sustain their housing. So 57% of all senior renters currently and a quarter of all senior homeowners are cost burdened. So more than half of our seniors who rent are paying more for their housing than they can afford. And particularly for seniors who nutrition and health and all these other demands, food, are so essential. This is causing a squeeze that is not healthy for our community. So what I would say is the state of our state's housing is insufficient. It's insufficient to meet the demands of our growing and thriving economy, and it's insufficient to meet the demands of our growing population. But the good news is that all of you have an opportunity to invest in solutions that we know work, solutions that are certainly represented within the Homes for All agenda. We're working tirelessly now on specific solutions to help local communities like the local housing trust funds, as well as things like the tax credit contribution fund that would help build a multi-sector contributions and coalition to be engaged in the housing conversation. So, I am available for questions as you wish.
Thank you very much. We have no questions at this point. We may later. Representative Kornstein.
Thank you, Ms. Mavity. That was one of the best and most concise and informative presentations I've ever seen on this topic, so I really appreciate it. There was one slide that especially came to my attention on page 8 at the top when you this looks at the unit gap.
Oh, yes.
And I'm interested to know, how much of this is related to the fact that we're just losing housing, we're losing affordable housing at such a high rate, and is that really playing into this particular issue?
Ms. Babbitty.
Chair and Representative, thank you. It is, absolutely. So we talk about affordable housing as needing both preservation of affordable units and production of new units just to keep up with the growth, certainly. But that number does represent and encompasses what we know year over year over year is that homes are often affordable and simply because they're old, that they don't have the fancy granite and stainless steel, but they're good solid housing. And so that unit gap does include what we talk about as the naturally occurring affordable housing that is either timing out of rent restrictions or is being reinvested in to a higher income tenant. Yeah, so that does represent that, and I would say that every year we continue to actually go backwards. We are losing more units than we are actually creating. So it's a growing challenge.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we'll move on to the Wilder work. And members, you have a handout, single night count of people experiencing homelessness, I believe, in your packets. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chairperson Hausman and representatives. My name is Greg Owen, and I'm a consulting scientist at Wilder Research. I've worked at Wilder Research since 1979. I started the statewide homeless study in 1991. Before that, we were doing studies of homelessness beginning in 1984 in St. Paul, and in 1986 and 1990 in Minneapolis. To be quite honest, I thought I was done doing statewide homeless studies at the end of the 90s, but the problem has not gone away. I'm here to talk about the most recent data from our 2018 survey that we conducted on October 25th, 2018. I'm going to run these slides. So the 2018 study is Wilder's 10th triennial study of homelessness. The backstory, as I said, dates back to 1984. In 1991, Commissioner Jim Solem, who was head of Minnesota Housing at that time, asked us if we could move this study and become a statewide, create a statewide portrait of homelessness for Minnesota. We expanded in 1991, and since 1991, we've conducted the study every 3 years. The study is unique in that it's unique in the United States in that it provides training for hundreds of volunteer interviewers, a cash honorarium to participants, collects information using in-depth face-to-face interview formats. The interview contains more than 100 questions with many sub-questions. Each interview lasts approximately 30 minutes. It's done face-to-face, personally, in shelters all around the state, as well as in locations not intended as shelter. The study conducted on October 25th included two components. The first is a count of all people staying in emergency shelters, domestic violence shelters, and transitional housing programs. The second is a survey of residents in these various shelter programs, as well as people located outside, doubled up, identified through outreach locations such as encampments, hot meal programs, and other drop-in service sites. To give you an example, in this past year, we were able to interview 200 people at the Hiawatha encampment before that encampment went to the Navigation Center. We're also able to interview people in St. Paul at the just over 35E in back of the James J. Hill House where there was another encampment. We try to get to these outreach locations through a variety of means, primarily by identifying people that are able to go to these sites and conduct interviews. Funding for the study comes from both public and private sources. Approximately half of the funding was provided by the state of Minnesota in 2018. The other half was raised from various philanthropies. A third and separate study is conducted on American Indian reservations in collaboration with tribal councils from all six participating reservations. Information from this study is reported separately, will come out later this year. The information I'm reporting today comes from the counts portion of the survey, includes an enumeration of all people in shelter locations as well as those who are not staying in formal shelters. Later this year, we'll release detailed information from the in-depth interview portion of the study representing both shelter and non-shelter users. This report will include detailed demographics as well as information on housing history, income, employment, service use, physical, mental, and chemical health, barriers to obtaining housing, and related health and human service needs. The counts portion of the survey, which is described in the fact sheet we recently published and which you have in front of you, shows that after a decline between 2012 and 2015, the overall number of people experiencing homelessness increased to peak 2012 levels, up 10% over 2015. The number of homeless children and youth aged 24 and younger are similar to the number counted in 2015. That is very little change in these numbers. Together, they represent nearly half of the homeless population, 46% in total. The number of homeless adults counted in 2018 increased from 2015. This growth was particularly apparent among those 55 and older. I'll just comment on Ann's comments earlier about the senior population, the growth of this population. This is one of the most troubling aspects that we're seeing. I was personally at the Harbor Light shelter interviewing where we see people with walkers and wheelchairs lined up for food service. This is a really significant change in the portrait of homelessness since I began doing this study back in the 80s. We have just heard from the Department of Human Services that they would like to commission a report that's specifically focused on senior homelessness. We'll be doing that during this next year, and we will release that report during this calendar year. Minnesota Housing Partnership figures show that there's 57% of renters who are seniors who are cost-burdened. As that cost burden increases and we look at the very bottom of that spectrum, we'll see some of those people falling into homelessness. We also had growth in the number of homeless adults aged 25 to 54. This group was up 20% in total. The number of people who are not in formal shelters increased considerably since 2015. That was up 62%. This is the highest number we've ever seen of people not staying in shelters. In total, 2,694 people were in this group, including just over half who had spent most of the previous month sleeping at encampments, in transit vehicles, or another location not intended for housing. Just under half of this group had spent most of the previous month doubled up with friends or family in temporary or other sporadic arrangements. We'll be able to report more detail on this finding when all survey results have been analyzed. Compared to 2015 levels, homelessness in the Twin City metro area grew by 9%. Homelessness in greater Minnesota grew by 13%. Two-thirds of the 2018 homeless population were found in the Twin City metro area, one-third in greater Minnesota. This distribution is similar to the distribution found in the 2015 study. All of the information I just reported are in the fact sheet. The slides, those last few facts were not in the slides, but they are all in the fact sheet that was provided earlier. I want to talk before closing about some of the survey data. Although the 2018 survey data is not yet available, we've been monitoring these trends every 3 years since 1991. I'd like to just show the trend lines on several of these facts since 2000, so over a 15-year period. First of all, the number of homeless families increased during the recession, and those numbers are now falling. This is encouraging news. It speaks to some of the very targeted efforts that are happening in our state and through our interagency work that focuses on reduction of family homelessness and trying to get children out of very short-term unstable situations as quickly as possible. We use rapid exit strategies. So the fact that we saw a 5% drop in homeless families in the 2018 figures was, again, an encouraging fact and follows that trend since 2012 where it peaked, where the number of homeless families had peaked. Mental health, physical health issues are increasing. This slide shows that graphic over time. If you look particularly at the yellow line, the red line rather, that shows serious mental health, these are based on health interview questions from the National Health Interview Survey. We asked people whether they've been told by a doctor or nurse in the last 2 years if they have any of the following diagnoses. Then we go through a series of diagnoses and people report whether or not they've been told by a doctor or nurse that they have such a diagnosis. One of the most troubling trends, if you go all the way back to the 90s, and I remember having a caucus meeting when former Governor Pawlenty was a caucus leader in the Republican caucus. I remember at that caucus he had asked what percent of people are good to go into housing without additional supports. And our answer at that time was maybe 25 to 27%. That figure has been going down. In terms of the kinds of barriers that are represented in people's lives to get to the to being able to live in some type of housing that doesn't have additional supports. But one of the figures that's most troubling here is the serious mental illness figure. And if you look back to the 90s reports, you would find figures of 25 to 27% of people with serious or persistent mental health. But in emptying out facilities for the mentally ill and moving toward a community mental health strategy, we have not really solved the problem of mental health housing for people, particularly those that may have tenuous connections with family. So we see this growth now up to 57% in 2015. We're going to be very interested to see what happens to that figure. The other thing I would point out, you see the chronic physical health problem line here. That number also has gone up substantially since 2000, up to over half that are reporting chronic physical health problems. If you look at our data related to just those 55 and older, you'll find that that number goes up into the 60s and 70%. And if we talk about people with disabilities, those numbers are similar. So we have a compounding problem among senior homelessness where we have people with very serious disabilities and physical health problems that are not able to get housing on a stable basis, and therefore their health is going to be constantly threatened, and we know that health doesn't improve if one doesn't have a stable place to live. SNAP use, I just talk about this for a minute. You know, the SNAP rules have changed a little bit. We saw a first drop in 2012 to 2015 in the number of people that were able to use what were formerly called food stamps. And this drop, we'll be very interested to see what happens to this next year. Now, obviously, homeless people or people experiencing homeless are able to use a variety of sources for food. Many hot meal programs. I work with a group called House of Charity in Minneapolis. They provide hot meals every day of the week, 365 days a year. But almost all people experiencing homelessness have to supplement food sources. SNAP has been an important one, up to almost 70%. And so now with this drop, with the changes in eligibility criteria, we're interested to see what's going to happen there. Homelessness is persistently homegrown. I just wanted to say that you see the number from 2000 to 2015. This is the percent of persons who have lived in Minnesota more than 2 years at the time we interview them. This number has stayed fairly constant. I can remember figures back in the 80s when we first doing studies in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and these figures were just as constant back then, roughly 25%, 22%, 20%. Had come to the Minnesota within the last 2 years. The vast majority of people had been in Minnesota. Many of these people have been here much longer than 2 years. They've been here their whole lives. And then finally, one of the red threads that concerns me more than anything is the red thread related to women fleeing abuse. Women fleeing abuse in 2015 were at their highest proportion. We see 35%. What was particularly troubling in the 2015 data was that we also saw the growth in the percent of women who were homeless as an immediate and direct result of domestic violence. So that figure had been around 25% over previous study cycles, and that jumped to 35% in the 2018 study cycle. This means that one of the underlying causes of homelessness in our state is the inability to live in a situation where violence is occurring. And so without addressing that underlying cause, this form of homelessness will not leave.
And, Mr. Owen, I'm assuming we can make those connections to two other things you've told us about.
Yes, please.
That is the growing amount of poverty and the growing amount of mental illness leads to the stress that affects a family in a home. I mean, I think those things probably are interrelated.
There are many studies that show that, yes. Thank you. Yes, that's a great point. Finally, there's one additional significant red thread that I'll just talk about, and that is the racial disparities in the population. African Americans and American Indians are far more likely to be homeless than members of other races. When we went to the encampment at Hiawatha, we were able to determine through a quick look at the data, and this is not final figures, but a quick look at the data showed roughly 70% of everybody at that encampment were American Indian people. We found a couple dozen people that were older adults in that population. There were over 55. We held a brief conversation with Indian elders at the American Indian Center shortly after that encampment had begun, and learned a lot more about the concerns that American Indian elders had about the absence of one paycheck and the potential loss of their housing, and the fact that that encampment was the next step for some of the elders that they knew and some of the elders that had taken part in that conversation. So that disparity has existed as long as we have been doing the study. It's really not changed. In the metro area, in the last study we found, I think, just under 50% of all people in metro area shelters were African American. All of these trends and issues will be updated in 2018 when the full study is available. Our next steps in May will provide you with a copy of our characteristics and trends fact sheet. That's the first pass at the survey data, so we'll be able to take the trend lines, extend them for 2018, some of the trend lines that I've spoken about today. In months to follow, we'll have detailed data about youth, older adults, veterans, and families. And I mentioned the older adult homeless report that was just commissioned by the Minnesota Department of Human Services and the Board on Aging. In partnership with six tribes, we'll provide a report on homelessness and near homelessness on the Native American reservations. We've been doing this study every 3 years since 2006. This is a partnership with the tribes. They own the data. We give it back to them. They review it. They decide whether or not it can be released to the public. Each time, they have agreed that it should be released to the public to tell the story about homelessness on reservations. Ongoing, we have continued work with policymakers to understand the meaning behind the trends, including effective interventions. And with that, I'll stop and take any questions.
Representative Hornstein has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Owen. This, again, a fantastic and important study. You did a really good job, again, of condensing this information. I first learned about the study a couple weeks ago. There was a headline in the Star Tribune, and it read, Minnesota's homeless population reaches record high number. And I didn't see that you had suggested it was a record high number in your presentation. So I wanted to know if you feel that that was accurately portrayed in the Star Tribune headline.
Mr. Owen.
Yes, thank you, Representative Ornstein. The number that we counted in 2018 was the highest number that we have ever counted. And that trend line in that one of those early graphics that I showed that number was past all of the previous numbers. So it is, in fact, a record number. I'm not sure what else to say about that. It's not a record I'd hope to break, but yes.
And what I recall seeing in this last week, the growth rate in the metro area is 9%, but in greater Minnesota it's 13%. And you mentioned the encampment. I think in some ways the issue has been more visible in the metro area and perhaps more hidden or less visible in greater Minnesota. It takes a different form.
Yes, and that's partly the result of the availability of shelters in greater Minnesota. We obviously have a lot more shelters, transitional housing, domestic violence shelters in the metro area. And so we've had this two-thirds, one-third split between the metro area and greater Minnesota pretty much for the full time of the study in terms of where the total population of people experiencing homelessness are residing. My sense of it is that growth that we saw, the 9% in this metro area and 13%, those are real figures, and partly we are better able now than we were, let's say, in the previous decade to identify and interview people who are in greater Minnesota who are homeless because the outreach efforts there are stronger. We've connected with more people who can help us identify pockets of homelessness that previously we were not able to identify.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Chair Hausman is now going to present House File 1151, our Omnibus Finance Policy Bill.
And Mr. Chair, before I make those motions, I just want to say just a word. The room is filled with housing advocates. You early on received the Homes for All agenda. They were hoping for reflection in this bill, in the tax bill, in the bonding bill, in health and human services. We're at the point in the session where our anxiety grows as we worry that that won't happen. You heard from two groups this morning about the urgency of this. I don't think I could have asked for more advocacy in this state. Hundreds of groups, thousands of people who've been part of this conversation. And so I'm still hoping for a miracle before the end of the session. But for now, I will move House File 1151.
Chair Hausman moves that House File 1151, and I believe the motion is to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
And I will further move the delete everything, which...
Chair Hausman moves the DE3 amendment, which gets the bill in the shape you would like it.
And I will say this reflects what we tried in this bill is at least to keep all of the programs on the spreadsheet so that we can still be talking about them. Representative Gunther isn't here right now. He's in Representative Mahoney's committee. I'm particularly sorry about the amount for the challenge grants, which is a very flexible kind of program. He has always been the author of that. And I found out yesterday that the challenge program not only didn't get new money in the Senate, but it was cut, so we have our work cut out for us.
Chair Hausman, I just want to clarify, it's actually the DE1 amendment.
Okay. So I move the DE1.
Any discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? DE1 amendment is adopted.
And am I moving the A2 or are you?
I can move the A2 as it relates to legislation that I have in the bottom. I'm going to move the A2 amendment, which adds some specific language related to the statewide tenant hotline. I'll move that amendment. Any discussion?
And that, Mr. Chair, was just an oversight. That little phrase didn't make it into the delete all, but that was our intention.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to express the same concerns I did before. I'm not sure that it's going to go directly to Homeline, but I do hope that we do have a bid, that it goes out to a bid process, and that we have other folks looking at it, too, and maybe working together. So,
thank you, Representative Tice. Any other discussion? All those in favor of the A2, say aye.
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 Opposed? A2 is adopted. Representative Hausman.
And, Mr. Chair, I believe we will just have Mr. Savory walk through the spreadsheet.
Mr. Savory.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. I'll be working from the spreadsheet that was found in your packets. Just for a little organizational purposes, the right two-hand columns on the right-hand side that are titled DE Amendment obviously refer to the DE Amendment as it's constructed currently. The center two columns labeled Governor reflect the Governor's most recent budgetary request in March. And then the two columns on the left-hand side represent the base appropriations found in the most recent February forecast for 20 and 21, and then the planning years of 22 and 23. More generally, the spreadsheet is laid out into sections of operations for the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. We'll go through each one. I'll list the changes to the programs, and then secondly, list any base programs that have stayed the same within the DE. So we'll get started. I'll refer to line numbers, and I'll be speaking directly from the DE amendment columns. Line 9 is a base increase for the challenge program. The $2 million increase in FY20 and a $2 million increase in FY21. That increase changes a little bit in the planning years, the tails. That increase goes from $2 million to $1.5 million each year in fiscal years 22 and 23. Line 10 is a one-time appropriation to the Local Housing Trust Fund Match Program. This is a new initiative that the governor brought forward. That is $7 million one-time in fiscal year 20. In total, when you add in the change items, the challenge program receives $14.9 million per year within the DE for 20 and 21 in each year. And then that reduces slightly in fiscal years 22 and 23 to $14.4 million in each year. Additionally, the Local Housing Trust Fund matches a one-time appropriation on line 13, which you can find in the bill. And on line 14, the Workforce Housing Development Program is $2 million. It is unchanged from the base in 20 and 21. We'll jump down to line 17, which is the Prevention and Homelessness Program category. We'll jump down further to line 25, which are the change items for that particular area. Line 25 is the Rental Assistance for Mobile Students, or the Homework Starts with Home Program. There was one-time funding previously in a prior bill. That funding has since expired, but this new money is $3 million per year and establishes a base for the program in 20 and 21 and going forward into the tails. Line 26 is the Rental Assistance for the Mentally Ill, or also known as the Bridges Program. This increases a previous base, so that is an increase of $1 million per year in 20 and 21. And then those $1 million increases continue into the tails. Line 27 is the increase to the Family Homeless Prevention Program. It is a $1 million increase each year on a permanent basis going forward. And so line 29 is just a reiteration of that, what the new totals are. The Housing Trust Fund remains unchanged at $11.6 million per year. Line 30 is the Rental Assistance for Mobile Students. The Homework Starts with Home program is the $3 million change in each year on line 30. Line 31 is the Rental Assistance to Bridges program. That shows the increase of a base of approximately $4 million. Now the new base or the new appropriation is $5 million. And line 32 is the Family Homeless Prevention Program. That shows the increase in the base of $1 million per year. It was $8.5 million and is now $9.5 million in 2021 and going forward. We'll skip down to line 37, which is the prevention section of the bill. Preservation section of the bill. Line 44 represents a changed or a establishment of the workforce home ownership program. Is it $1 million per year, and then the tails decrease slightly to $500,000 each year in 20 and 23. So line 46, you'll see that change item be brought into the current bill. Line 47 represents no change to the Affordable Rental Investment Fund. Line 48 represents no change to the Housing Rehabilitation, the Home Owner-Occupied program portion of that program. And then the same thing on line 49 for the rental housing portion of the Housing Rehabilitation Program. Those are all at base. Line 53 represents the Home Ownership Assistance Fund. That remains the same in the bill as it has in prior years at $885,000 per year. We'll skip down to line 58, which is residential and organization support. And then we'll flip the page over. Line 65 represents a bill the committee heard regarding lead paint abatement. That is a new program now established at $1 million per year. And that appropriation decreases by half in the out years in 20 and 23. So it goes from $1 million to $500,000 in 20 and 23. Line 66 represents an increase to the capacity building grants. That increases $100,000 per year in 20 and then $100,000 in 20 and 21. Or 21, excuse me. Line 67 represents an increase to the Home Ownership Capacity Program. That increases $400,000 per year, and that goes into the tails as well. And so we'll skip down to line 69, which just shows that the lead paint abatement program is now in the bill and in the base at $1 million per year and $500,000 in the tails. Line 70 represents base funding for the Home Ownership Education and Counseling and Training Program at $857,000 per year. Line 71 represents the increase to the capacity building grants. And line 72 is just an allowable amount out of that for the information IT system for homelessness. And then line 73 represents a grant to Build Wealth Minnesota, which is unchanged. And then line 74 is, as I mentioned before, is the Home Ownership Capacity Program, $400,000 per year.
So, Mr. Chair, our target was $26 million. $10 million of that was one-time money. That's what the spreadsheet reflects. And then the language of the bill is primarily just reflecting this. Ms. Dyson may want to comment. Anything that you would like to call out?
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, they're really the only two things I wanted to flag in terms of new language, the Local Housing Trust Fund grants on page 2 of the Delete All Amendment. This is a new program, and it goes to the local housing trust funds, and it spells out how the amounts available for grantees and how the money can be spent. And that was presented in this committee by Representative Howard and was also in the original bill, House File 1151, and the governor's bill. The other provision is in Article 2 at the end of the Delete All Amendment on page 8, and that's the statutory program established for the Lead Safe Home Grant Program that Representative Fisher presented to the committee. And that establishes the grant program for lead testing and in rental housing, and then making them doing some abatement work. So those are the two programs that had new language that I wanted to highlight.
So, Mr. Chair, we have some testifiers. The first two are down for both bills, and I think may choose just to comment on the second one. So, Mr. McDonough and Mr. Cervantes will be testifying on the informational hearing we're having today.
It looks like up first for the public testifiers of Libby Murphy with Homes for All Policy Co-Chair and Minnesota Housing Partnership.
Good morning, Chair, members. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I just want to thank the committee and for these new investments in the continuum of housing from rental assistance to production and to encourage local solutions and innovations with the local housing trust funds. This really represents an investment in the continuum of housing, which the Homes for All Coalition advocates for every day. And so we appreciate that. But I will say it's not enough. We heard from the two presentations today just how dramatic our housing needs are. We are in a housing crisis, and these investments do not reflect the need across the state. If we are to address the deficit in the number of units available and affordable to our most vulnerable households, we need more resources for new production and preservation. And we need more resources for rental assistance so that more than one in four households who are eligible can actually receive the assistance that they need. And we cannot address our disparities if we continue to underinvest in housing. So I urge the committee members to advocate for a larger target. And if that is an impossible task, then to find and advocate for investments through the bonding bill and the tax committee. Again, thank you. And again, this does represent new investments across the continuum, and we are grateful for that and grateful for the opportunity to have had the ability to testify on these various bills before.
Thank you. Next up, I have Charlie Vanderardi, the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Charlie Vanderardi for Metro Cities, which represents the collective interests of cities across the seven-county metropolitan area. As you've heard this session, housing that's affordable for Minnesotans is a priority for Minnesota cities. With the region forecast to add over 700,000 new residents by 2040, cities are surveying their current housing stock and planning for future housing needs. Those needs will need to be met by preserving existing homes and building new homes. This finance bill commits resources to both needs. Funding increases to the Challenge Program recognize state support to meet a range of locally identified needs, both single-family and multifamily, both owner-occupied and rental. Thanks to Representative Gunther for carrying that bill. The Workforce Homeownership Program also supports homeownership for working families. We appreciate the city eligibility and funding. The finance bill also helps communities which have committed to raising funds locally amplify state funding via a state match. Thanks to Representative Howard for carrying that bill. As our metro region grows and as the state grows, state support will continue to be even more critical, to be more critical for cities. We look forward to working with the committee, and thank you for your support.
Thank you. Next up, Michael Dahl from Homeline.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, I want to state my support for the Homes for All Coalition and to the work of this committee for taking a very comprehensive approach to what is a very complex problem that our state is facing. I appreciate that you funded everything from family homeless prevention to helping renters with extremely low-income households and also people getting into home ownership opportunities. Taking a comprehensive approach is absolutely necessary. I wanted to testify specifically, though, about the bill that Representative Howard carried and Representative Housen put in the bill for the Capacity Building Grant Program with its support for free legal confidential advice to Minnesota tenants. Homeline provides this service, and during this last quarter, we saw a 7% increase in the number of people contacting our program. There are more people who need help getting repairs, more people who need help negotiating with their landlords, more help for people who are seeing rent increases, and so we're very happy that you've included this. I'm sad to report that in the Senate, they actually took four programs that dealt with capacity building and counseling and put them together into one bill and focused most of those needs on home ownership counseling. And so we do not have the support that we need for rental assistance. I'm sorry, for rental advice or legal advice for renters that is specifically called out in the Senate bill. Thank you for your time, and thank you for what the work this committee has done.
Thank you. Next, we have Dan Kitzberger from Minnesota Housing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dan Kitzberger, I'm the legislative director with Minnesota Housing. Both the commissioner and Assistant Commissioner Baumtrog are unable to be here, so I'm pinch hitting on their behalf. I just want to start out by saying how much we appreciate the work of the committee over the past few months. As you've all come to know, housing truly impacts everyone everywhere in the state. And while the needs may differ depending upon where you are or be specific to a region, we're very glad for this committee's interest and energy dedicated to addressing the needs of the housing needs of Minnesotans everywhere. So I wanted to start out by thanking you for including the governor's full recommendation for Homework Starts with Home. This is a proven program, and funding it in the base will allow resources to reach more areas of the state and stabilize more families with children in school. We're also glad to see that there's some overlap in areas with the governor that the governor has prioritized, such as in the Challenge, Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program, Bridges, the Local Housing Trust Fund, and home ownership capacity. We're looking forward to working with you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee in the coming weeks of session to create a budget that helps meet the needs of more people throughout the state. So thank you again very much.
Thank you. Next up, we have Sean McAllaton with North Country Cooperative Foundation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak this morning. I think you hear a lot about data about housing, and I think the first two speakers this morning gave the committee members ample tools to make the policy decisions that you need. I want to talk a little bit about the people I represent, people who live in manufactured home communities. Most of the people that I represent can't afford most of the housing that's supported by members of this committee. So housing affordable to people at 60% of area median income, 50% of area median income, is beyond the reach of most of the people that I represent. Who are these people? They're the people who empty the waste baskets, sweep the floors, vacuum the carpets in this building and in the Capitol. They're the truck driver who drops off Twinkies and Doritos at the convenience store where we buy them. They're the clerks who ring up our purchases there. They're the personal care attendants at the local nursing home. They're the roofer who's manning the nail gun to replace a roof down the street. And they're the people like the residents of Sun Gold Heights Manufactured Home Community in Worthington, Minnesota. And if I could have a page, pass out this handout. This is a community, these are residents we've been working with for the last 6 months to buy the community that they live in. They have very low rents. We found out 2 weeks ago when our engineers came back with a study that the infrastructure serving that community is beyond repair. It'll cost about $900,000 to replace that infrastructure system, about half the cost of the community. We're working hard with Minnesota Housing Finance Agency now to try to come up with some money to preserve that community. But there's no pot of money for that type of affordable housing. So we were back in a couple of bills this session, House File 1830, Senate File 1871, which would have put some money into the Manufactured Housing Infrastructure Fund. That's not in the current bill. We also backed Representative Sock's bill, House File 896, Senate File 469, that would have given manufactured home communities access to several pots of money available to other housing providers. That's a bill that was drafted by a bipartisan, bicameral group of 20 to 30 legislators who support manufactured housing. four components to that bill. One that would give manufactured homeowners the right to petition cities to issue bonds for failing infrastructure. That's in the current bill. The other would expand access to the manufactured housing infrastructure bill fund, which again is unfunded in the current bill. And that's the expanded access is in, no money. Two provisions, access to challenge funds and housing improvement bonds, are not in the current bill. So I would ask the committee members, I thank you for the support that you've already given for manufactured housing, and I'd ask for continued support for manufactured housing. I'm happy to take any questions.
And before you go, could you state your name?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Sean McElhattan. I'm the Chief Development Counsel for North Country Cooperative Foundation.
Thank you. Representative Pearson.
And Mr. Chair, I agree with everything he has said, and I know there are members of this committee who are going to work hard in the interim to continue to meet that challenge, because we've been reminded over and over this is affordable housing desperately needed. The good news at this moment, just as we've tried to move as many items forward, my understanding is that this is funded in the Senate bill, and so we do have another opportunity in conference committee should we miraculously get just a little more money assigned to us. So I saw that as good news.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Pearson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just to clarify that just a little bit further, within this actual bill, though, there are manufactured homes, I understand, actually fit in kind of the in-between where, because the lots are rented, they don't qualify for home ownership type of programs, and because the improvement or the house that's on the lot is on a rented lot, they also don't qualify for the rental assistance. Is there anything that is in this bill that addresses or enhances and improves this this one?
There is funding for the HOOM program, the Workforce Home Ownership Minnesota program, and those are funds that we would have access to.
Okay.
With other housing providers. And, yeah.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair. Just again, looking at the affordability of when we talk about some of these other programs, this sheet that talks about lot rents being at $330, then going up to $360 if this co-op took ownership, I understand, of the entire park. What would you say with the addition of the improvement that is on the rented lot, what would you say like the average investment for one of these types of units would be in southwestern Minnesota?
So typically, the lot rents are pretty typical in Worthington, $300 to $350. There's quite a range, but that's pretty typical. Typical manufactured home purchase is under $10,000, and usually it's not financed. You buy it from your brother-in-law or somebody who knows a neighbor, and you maybe put $1,000 down and make a couple hundred bucks a month payment. So again, your all-in payment would typically be $500-$600 a month, and again, once that's paid off by you're paying the price of the home, then your rent is $300 a month.
So I just looking at the numbers and again how we try to subsidize. I mean that amount per month just for the lot rent is typically lower than what we pay to subsidize rent in a lot of other locations. So again, I the preservation of this again strikes me as something that should be a priority, and the opportunity is there to provide a great living environment for people. So thank you.
All right, our next testifier is Sue Wetla Phillips with MICA.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm the executive director of MICA, the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, and vice president of the National Coalition for the Homeless. I want to thank Representative Hausman and all of you for the great work that you have done around this bill, for Homes for All, and really pulling together a coalition of very diverse interests in developing a continuum of housing resources from prevention all the way through home ownership. And I think this is a critical way to work together. A couple comments I'd like to just make on some of the previous testimony that you've heard today, and just a little bit of expansion. As Ann Mavity talked about from Minnesota Housing Partnership, you know, we have the growing number of people that are in a housing crisis right now and that are at risk of being homeless. To put real numbers to that, that means we need to expend $1 billion here in the metro area and $1 billion in greater Minnesota every year to address that issue. We know how to spend money on housing and do it very well for those of us that are homeowners, and I bought the house that I grew up in. And so we have the mortgage interest deduction that goes up to $750,000 with the change in the federal tax law. We also have your property taxes as well as capital gains. So we really need to be putting both budgets as well as the bonding budgets on the table as we are really looking at how are we going to address the housing crisis that we're in the state as well as in the country. So we need to look at tax expenditures, appropriations, and bonding together as we're really coming up with our solutions, and encourage as we continue to move ahead to do that. In addition to that, just wanted to add that as Mr. Owen was talking about the people that are new to the state that are experiencing homelessness, IRS indicates that 20 to 25% of the American population moves every year trying to get employment. So it's not an unusual situation that a part of that population would also find themselves at risk or experiencing homelessness also. Just want to echo what Sean said just a few minutes ago. Our manufactured homes are our most affordable housing. It's home ownership. We need to preserve this. We need to find the resources to do that, and strongly encourage you to do that. Thank you so much for all your service, and look forward to continuing to work with you.
Thank you. Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair and members, I will say the faith community has stepped up big time on this particular crisis that we're facing, and have been here consistently providing a message for us.
Next up, Daniel Lightfoot with League of Minnesota Cities.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I will try to be brief as I know we have another informational hearing on a bill that we have to get to, but Daniel Lightfoot with the League of Minnesota Cities here on behalf of our 833 member cities in the state of Minnesota, and I'd like to thank Chair Hausman and members of the committee for the leadership on this issue and continuing to work on solutions that seek to address the affordable housing issues that cities across the state of Minnesota are facing. And I'm pleased to note that a lot of that committed work is apparent in this bill before the committee today. Cities across the state continue to be concerned about the need for proactive commitment at the state level to aid city efforts to meet demand for affordable housing that is sensitive to local conditions, emerging trends, and changing demographics. The lack of affordable housing is reverberating across the state, with over a quarter of Minnesota families spending more than 30% of their household income on housing. With vacancy rates remaining low and the market struggling to keep up with the demand for new construction of new affordable housing options, and communities struggling to maintain existing naturally occurring affordable housing. Cities understand their important role in building and maintaining the proper tools and flexibility to meet the housing needs of their residents. To that end, cities have implemented solutions at the local level, such as inclusionary zoning, tax abatement, TIF for housing, increased density, and local housing trust funds. However, increasing sustainable resources dedicated to affordable housing, along with developing additional tools that provide flexibility for cities to create partnerships and leverage resources, will be necessary if we are to effectively address the affordable housing crisis. The resources outlined in House File 1151 are an excellent start in providing the capital needed to support the affordable housing priorities. I'd like to briefly highlight a couple of the provisions in the bill that will be crucial resources for cities in addressing their locally identified housing needs. First, the increase in base funding of $4 million this biennium and $3 million next biennium for the Challenge Fund grant program will be crucial for communities to leverage local public and private resources to develop workforce rental and single-family homes. the sustained investment in the Workforce Housing Grant Program, as well outlined in Article 1, Section 2 of the bill, will continue to provide much-needed resources to spur development of workforce housing, particularly in greater Minnesota. I want to extend my appreciation to Representative Gunther for his leadership on the Challenge Program, carrying that bill, and really shepherding that program, the Challenge Fund Program, since the program's inception. We also appreciate the funding in the bill for the Workforce Home Ownership Program and the inclusion of city eligibility for the program as well to create additional workforce housing opportunities. Lastly, the Local Housing Trust Fund state match, this is an important tool for cities to dedicate local public resources to address locally identified housing needs. Several cities in Minnesota have already established local housing trust funds, but the state match funding carried by Representative Howard will help jumpstart local investment and spur the creation of more local housing trust funds across the state. And to conclude, I'd like to note that while the League is pleased with the funding priorities laid out in the bill, we also recognize that the scope of the affordable housing crisis is such that additional resources should be considered outside of general appropriations, as we've heard this morning. This includes resources in the tax bill for the Tax Credit Contribution Fund, as well as bonding resources via housing infrastructure bonds and general obligation bond resources. We encourage members of this committee and your colleagues in this body to seriously consider those proposals as conversations continue on how to put our best foot forward in addressing this crisis. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. And are there any other members of the public that would like to testify?
We don't have much time.
Super quick. Not even bringing up remarks.
Hello, thank you. My name is Dominic McQuarrie, Public Policy Manager at the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation. Just quickly wanted to thank the chair and committee for the appropriations in this bill that are going towards affordable housing, and speaking specifically about the Homework Starts with Home program. We all know the importance of a stable place and a stable home to grow and thrive, not just academically, but socially and emotionally as well. So thank you to the many members of the committee that are on that bill and for their support. I think that, you know, what was shown in the Wilder Research Report around children and families and what we've seen in some of the work around veterans is that when we focus on a population, we can make gains in the issues around homelessness. So I thank the committee for choosing to take part in a housing-focused committee this session, because if we continue to move forward, we can really make strides on this issue.
Thank you. Are there members that would have any questions or comments? Representative Johnson.
Chair Howard, Chair Hausman, I want to thank you for this bill. It's got a lot of good stuff in it. There might be something I don't always agree with in this bill, but what I don't agree with is what's missing. One of the things that's missing in this bill is things to help reduce rules and regulations to keep the cost of housing down. That's missing. We heard testimony how just being across a imaginary line can be a 50% reduction in the cost of building a home. And that's because of rules and regulations. One of the fastest growing communities or counties in our area is across the river in St. Croix County, Wisconsin. And there's a huge difference in the cost of building a home from this side of the river to the other side of that river. Yeah. And we need to work on those issues, but that's not addressed in this bill. Also, Minnesota housing finances. This bill has $131 million in it, over $131 million. By our state budget, that's not a lot of money, but to me, that is a lot of money. We have no idea where that money goes once it leaves here, because it's all in grants. And we don't get a report where it goes. Now, I have two projects dealing with MHFA literally on the edge, each edge, east and west edge of my district, one in the city of North Branch, one in the city of Princeton. They were allocated and awarded the grants in 2017. It's 2019 now, and they're still fighting to get their funding. projects are putting on hold and have possibility of being completely over and done and not even getting started because of holding up of the funding to get these projects started, and the costs are going up. Get to the point now where they might not be able to afford the projects because the costs have gone up that high. There's also, I believe, a couple projects I was told about this morning on a half-hour phone conversation dealing with this. There's two projects in St. Cloud that are also dealing with the same issues. So that has a lot of concern for me because we're allocating funding, giving out the grants. The money's not being allocated. Where is the money going? Is it getting pigeonholed somewhere? We don't know. So I guess what I would like to ask the chair to think about doing, either as an amendment or a requirement for next session, is have MHFA prepare a report for us, going back 5 years, to have for us when the session starts next year, the number of grants that were allocated. Not just the number, but where the grants were allocated. So we can look at, is this funding going to the proper places? And what parts of states it's going to. The percent of the funds allocated to the projects that was granted. And if the funds weren't allocated, why not? That's information we need to know so we can actually work harder in getting things done right. But also finding out if these projects are actually working to reduce the health, or reduce housing costs, reduce homelessness. But without those reports, we don't know if what we're doing is proper. So I hope you consider doing that.
Chair Husband, any comments?
Well, I'm assuming that Mr. Kitzberger will connect with you about the particular where the grants have already been made, but the funding hasn't arrived. So hopefully after the meeting, he's able to connect with you, and I think that reporting about what actually is done is good advice.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Houseman, thank you for bringing the bill forward. Housing, of course, is very dear to my heart, and I know a lot of the struggles that are happening, and I'm active in our community as well, not only with the Central Minnesota Mental Health Center, but also with different homeless groups. And I also work a lot with McKinley High School, which has a lot of students that are homeless. And I was so pleased, and I can't say it enough, that Commissioner Hogue actually went to McKinley and met with some of the students. And that's very encouraging. So we can figure out some of the programs and things that maybe we need to put in place, or even just educating the teens themselves about what is available to them. I think a lot of times they don't think they're homeless because they're couch surfing. And we need to do a better job of probably educating on what that is. But that being said, we have a lot of work to do yet. And I know you know that. The Governor's Task Force on Housing, the first three recommendations are commit to homes as a priority, preserve the homes we have, and then build more homes. And again, I can't say it enough, we need to look at the codes, the fees, the mandates, and really figure out what can we do and what can we ask our communities to do as well. I know the counties and the cities aren't going to like it, but I think that if we're going to look at home, you know, having the homes for the folks that we have and workforce housing especially, we need to look at those mandates and stuff. When we look at the chart that was just presented today, and we're looking at, you know, we're worse than our neighboring states. And why is that? We need to figure out why are we worse than our neighboring states. And that has to do a lot with the costs and having those conversations. And I know we can't have everything in the bill, but it really is frustrating that we don't have manufactured homes in here, because that could help a lot with our aging population as well. I think that has the potential to really have some really cool communities. You go down south, and it's you know, parks upon parks upon parks, and they do it all the time. And I think it's something we really need to look at. And I've had several folks that have said, hey, you're in building or remodeling. Why are you talking about manufactured homes? But quite frankly, we can't build them affordable. And so this is another great way to say this is an option that we can do and also have a nice community that will address the needs of the folks, whether it be it just be folks that need affordable housing or aging. I'm really concerned about aging. It would be nice to see that. I just really have concerns with the amendment that we put on because of Homeline. I don't think there's a lot of groups that have lobbyists and they advocate here at the legislature that gets funding for projects. And I really hope that that goes out to bid. I think it really needs to. I'm concerned about the message it sends. So just can't say it enough. I just, that one really bugs me. But I do appreciate being on this committee and working with this. Like I said, it's my heart. Did it for 30-some years. And I really can't push enough, too, when we talk about, you know, preserving our homes, that we really do probably educate folks on what that means. We at one time had 13 homes, and each one had some type of upgrades to it, depending on how old the home was and what was there. And I would say most of the time we put in between $3,000 and $70,000 and had a really nice home. And a lot of times we're looking at new appliances, and we can't always do the woodwork and things like that, which lead to the lead issues. But there is a lot you can do, and there's a lot of resources you can find to help redo the homes so that they are acceptable for families to live in. So, again, I thank you very much. It's been very nice to be on the committee, and I look forward to probably doing a lot of work this summer so that we can figure out why our costs are so expensive and probably just start with that, and where do we start with looking at the codes, the mandates, the fees, that type of thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. I know we're short on time. Just a brief comment of mine on the bill. I want to thank Chair Hausman for your leadership in bringing forward a bill that I think really does have a strategic use of our resources on the continuum of housing. I want to thank the community members and advocacy organizations that have helped us kind of put a spotlight on this crisis. I, too, want to kind of join what we've heard from some testifiers and members, though, that you know, I think we've done a good job this session in continuing to raise the profile and put a spotlight on the need for housing. The resources we have before us today in this committee, you know, really frankly doesn't come close to meeting that undisputable, undeniable need. You know, I really think we're in a fight for the stability, economic security, and safety of hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans and communities, and frankly we're losing that fight. And even with the resources in this bill, I'm not convinced we're not still going to be going backwards. And so I just want to underscore again how vital it is that we not only pass this bill, but make investments in our tax bill. Representative Tabke has an excellent tax credit proposal in particular, and that we advocate vigorously on behalf of all of our constituents to have a robust bonding bill that invests in housing as well. It's so vital to the overall effort to continue to meet this crisis. Representative Hausman. Representative Sock.
Thank you. I was prepared to not say anything. I have to tell you that as I sat here, you all know where my advocacy was because I saw it as a sweet spot in the purview of this. And I think that a number of people have said some very important and wise things. But when we as a committee have completely walked past the opportunity, if you look at building an apartment house, building all kinds of subsidized houses, building projects around, and we're subsidizing those things, and we walked past the opportunity to invest at about $100,000 per family for the possibility to actually own that and then move on in life from that position of ownership, I think we are being driven oftentimes by our legacy bias. I grew up in that bias, so I know it very well, and it steeped in my head right now, and I feel very disappointed that that's what has happened in this project. I couldn't end without saying that, so I'm sorry for the emotion in that, but I think we have missed it completely by walking past what are the least expensive ways to help people have housing.
Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, I think your comments summed it up perfectly. I couldn't have said it better. And if you're ready, I will renew my motion that 1151 be moved as amended to Ways and Means.
Representative Hausman renews her motion. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries and moves on to Ways and Means.
And, Mr. Chair, we have one additional bill which we're not moving. It came in very late. It's an idea about an emerging, as we've already said, there are so many needs. And I don't know if there's another committee waiting outside or if we could at least take some testimony on this. We're only hearing it for information.
What? We will just check momentarily to see if there's another committee.
We might at least move the first people to the table.
Very good.
Come on down.
Chair Hausman, thank you for getting this on the agenda so quickly. Chair, members of the committee, you've heard from the Minnesota Housing Partnership about the issues. Oh, I'm sorry. Jim McDonough, Ramsey County Commissioner, Chair of the Ramsey County Board. You've heard from the Minnesota Housing Partnership about the issues around affordability and the fragile situation so many of our residents are living in on a day-to-day basis about either staying in their housing or being able to find housing. The Walder Report did a really nice job of demonstrating what happens when that family or that individual loses that housing or cannot find that housing. And I'm going to pull out one bullet here from the Walder Report. The number of people not in formal shelter outside or doubled up increased considerably since 2015, 62%. And that's why I'm going to share with the committee that we have a crisis right now in front of us today on our streets. We have people living in the streets. The first encampment that I seen popped up last night on East 7th and Mounds Park, two tents, tarps, pile of firewood, and a number of trash cans, and that will grow, I'm sure, today, and it'll grow bigger tomorrow. And we've seen what happened with the encampments last year in Minneapolis and St. Paul. The agreed-upon number of unsheltered homeless people is 500 to 700, and that are those that are turned away from Higher Ground, from Union Gospel, all the places where we have opportunities for shelter at night. These are the people that can't get into those shelters. They go to our trains, they go into our communities, they go under bridges. At Ramsey County, we already have invested over $1 million over our budget on what we had planned to spend. This is not a local problem. It is very much a regional and state problem. I'm asking you as a legislature to treat it as such. Locals bear the brunt when there isn't enough capacity. I want to share a little bit about our winter safe space. 2 years ago, we seen an issue on the trains and the skyways in downtown St. Paul. We knew that the numbers were growing, so we pulled together in partnership with the City of St. Paul, Catholic Charities, St. Paul Foundation. We opened up a temporary winter safe space in the basement of our human service building. We accommodated 50 mats from December 1st to March 31st, and all the partners agreed that that was a one-year bridge and that we would address the issue so we did not have to reopen that. We knew immediately, especially with the issues around the encampments, we were going to have to open it up again last winter. We actually opened it up a month later. It's staying open a month longer. We added two more hours to the ability for them to stay during the day, and we added 14 more mats. And even with that added capacity, there were a number of times this year because of the extreme cold that we had to open up Union Depot for a couple nights. Sheriff Fletcher opened up the law enforcement for a couple nights so we could get people off the street so we didn't have people dying on the street. And that's why I say we have a crisis unfolding in front of us. We've seen it this winter, and we're going to see it grow this summer. As a former tradesman, I'm a glazier by trade. I worked construction for 30 years. I could not get my job done with a complete toolbox. You can't put a screw in with a hammer, and you can't cut a piece of wood with a drill. You need a complete toolbox. And this is some of the housing improvement bonds are an expansion of that toolbox that we have as a community, as a county, as cities, as partners within the community. Our nonprofits, a tool of that toolbox for our nonprofits who are a vital part of our network. I also need to remind you, as leaders, it's been pointed out that this is important, that this is in addition to capital supports. We remember the immediate needs facing us as this summer. As of yesterday, I already mentioned the first tents began to appear in St. Paul, and we need increased state support through the Emergency Service Grant Funding and the consideration of state sites as temporary spaces
to offer for individuals to sleep this summer. We have been in conversations and communications with the lieutenant governor, state agencies, and others on this important topic. I would be happy to meet with you, any of you as individuals. I know you're tight on time for questions, but I want to make sure you fully understand the impact that's happening in our community. I would spend time with each and every one of you to help provide more information. As I leave today, we need to recognize that this capital approach is important, but we also face a summer in which 500 to 700 unsheltered individuals are projected to be living in our community without a place to go. Now, I'm in an unusual spot. There's a number of times where I've sat with my Hennepin County commissioners and we've testified together. Commissioner Green, who chairs the county, Hennepin County Board, and Commissioner Jan Callison, who chairs their legislative commission, asked me to actually testify on their behalf. And so with the chair's indulgence, I would just like to read a brief statement from the Hennepin County Board in their support of these bonds. It is Hennepin County's priority to address the unsheltered challenge and state support and resources necessary to do this. Specifically, Hennepin County supports the expansion of Housing Infrastructure Bond Program to include housing stabilization. Hennepin County will be working with its stakeholders who are working on the unsheltered and homeless challenges for the remainder of the session so that the administration and legislators have the information before them to advance these critical issues for the entire state. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify. Thank you, Chair Houseman, for your leadership on this issue.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, he's speaking specifically to housing infrastructure bonds, and the bill that we're hearing for information would add housing stabilization projects as an additional use.
And that's House File 2767. And for members of the committee and the public, we're going to try to go another 15, 20 minutes or so.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Steve Horsfield. I'm Executive Director with Timpson Housing Services. I really just want to take a brief moment to call very specific attention to this concept of housing stabilization. At Timpson Housing Services, we've been operating shelter in South Minneapolis for 37 years. As our programs have grown and we now include 400 units of supportive housing services to people who are formerly homeless, we continue to strategically prioritize that shelter work. And the reason is because of that, this very concept of housing stabilization. That's what it is. That's where we engage with folks who are in crisis, in immediate crisis around housing. And from our 66-bed shelter in South Minneapolis, we move about 140 people each year through that program into permanent housing back into the community, truly doing this work of housing stabilization. Most recently, last fall, we in partnership with the City of Minneapolis, Red Lake Nation, and another number of other critical community partners, we began operating the shelter services at the Navigation Center, which was the temporary shelter that was erected to replace the very significant encampment that we had over on Hiawatha and Franklin in South Minneapolis. When we initiated that work, we had about 175 folks ultimately that we moved into that camp by the time all was said and done around January 1st of this year. I'm very pleased to be able to sit here this morning and tell you that that number is now below 90 in terms of residents at the Navigation Center, more than 50 of which have been stabilized into permanent housing back in our communities. One of the chief lessons that we're getting from this is this was arguably one of the a part of our community that has the most significant barriers to housing, long-term homelessness, legal problems, a whole litany of things. And no one is unhousable when we bring them in. We work wrap services around into a good temporary housing model and begin that work. And we're proving that out time and time again. Right now, this morning, we've got caseworkers doing that work at the Navigation Center with those remaining 90 folks. And we, as Simpson, is looking forward to the future. We are excited about the idea of some new design concepts we have for our shelter where we would go to a 24/7 operation. Imagine if we're moving 140 folks now and we're not even open during business hours from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. That's because we operate from 5 p.m. to 9 a.m. Imagine how many folks we could move if we were able to do that during the day. At this point, all of this work for our agency and for many others is done wholly on the back of
faith organizations, on private donors, and we raise about $500,000 each year to operate our shelter. As we look to for future investment, look at purpose design space, more dignity, better housing placement outcomes. This sort of infrastructure investment is absolutely needed at the state level. So I thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. My name is Ricardo Cervantes. I'm the Director of the Department of Safety and Inspections with the City of St. Paul. I come here to, one, support our partners in the good work that's going on in regards to housing those that need shelter, and specifically to talk about the city's impact in regards to the unsheltered homeless. I also want to thank you for your leadership, as well as the work you've done around the local housing trust, as well as the work that's going on around the rental assistance. As you know, St. Paul has over 51% of its population renting, as well as the home ownership programs, which would allow for folks to build equity and stabilize their housing. In regards to the City of St. Paul, we play an important role in addressing the housing or the homeless issue in our city. There are multiple touch points and responsibilities that cities have, such as responding to complaints, coordinating outreach, cleaning and clearing encampments, investing in affordable housing, and generally ensuring the health and safety of all who live in our city, regardless of where they live. But there really exists a complex and essential system of interdependent relationships, and you've heard from many of those that are providing those services. In our case, I'm talking about Ramsey County, the nonprofit social service and shelters such as Higher Ground St. Paul, Union Gospel Mission, and a host of other supportive housing programs. They truly hold the key to moving our unsheltered homeless into safe and sustainable housing. Last year at our encampment in St. Paul, I-35 and Cathedral Hill, we had over 75 people at its peak living in tents. And that is just an estimate of the number of people that are living outside of housing in the city. We estimate it's well over 200 in any one given day, living in their cars or other places unintended for habitation. The impact to the city is great when it comes to cost. When we look at the number of departments that are involved with addressing and trying to service those that are unsheltered, we have coordination, legal review, police, medical response, regular inspections, cleanups, and so forth. And this has put a burden on the city in regards to our managing of this issue. I want to say that we are here in support of the bills that are being proposed that are adding additional resources. There is a need for shelters. There is a need for more housing. Along all points of the housing continuum, there is a need, but at low barrier and supportive services that are essential now to bring to begin to address the current and future levels of our unsheltered homeless population. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representative House and members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Anderson. I am the Executive Director of Aspire Minnesota. We are an association of providers of children's services across the state and also represent the Youth Services Network, and that includes all of the homeless youth-serving providers statewide as well. And we just come to offer our enthusiastic support for this concept. Representative Hausman was instrumental in the housing infrastructure bonds generation, and it has proven to be a really significant innovation in our state to leverage these resources in addition to philanthropic resources and other identifiable resources to build infrastructure. And this, accordingly, is similarly another fantastic innovation to really think about housing stabilization and expand and leverage resources for that purpose. Particularly for young people experiencing homelessness, we know that, similar to the needs you've heard today, there are over 6,000 young people on any given night experiencing homelessness. We have 180 shelter beds, and this just one tidbit speaks to how critically important this innovation can be for young people, for all Minnesotans. So thank you so much for your leadership on this.
Thank you. Are there any other testimonies?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Madam Chair, thank you so much for having us today. For the record, I am Wendy Underwood with Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis. I want to speak to one other opportunity this bill provides, and then I'm happy to help with questions on the bill overall. But I want to address another piece of housing stabilization and our unsheltered homeless need, and that has to do with our medically frail, and how this bill allows an opportunity to increase what we describe as a homeless medical respite. Currently, Catholic Charities of St. Paul and Minneapolis is the only provider working with hospitals in our region to be able to provide an opportunity for when a hospital is seeing a homeless person for something like influenza, or this winter they saw a lot of frostbite, something where the homeless person needs that hospital medical care to become stabilized, get on medication, but once they no longer meet that hospital level of care, are you're dismissed or let go back to the street, and it creates this really terrible cycle of that of the homeless person just basically coming right back into the hospital. And we all know how much we have capacity challenges with our hospitals, and what the person really needs is a roof and a bed and fluids and rest to finish healing. Today, Catholic Charities works with our hospital partners in St. Paul and Minneapolis so that the hospital may discharge the homeless person to our medical respite facility. We have 16 beds in St. Paul and 10 in Minneapolis to be able to just do this work. The housing stabilization would allow for other entities to work in this space around the state. And so that's a small piece of this that I think is really important to share. And then I'm just happy to finish by saying we really, really appreciate the extensive conversation today about our growing homeless challenges and our unsheltered homeless, and how much all of us in this room recognize the need to be providing an increase to our programming. And there's great opportunities in the bill you've passed earlier today. There's a lot of important conversations happening in Chair Liebling's committee. But we also need to provide access to capital to give that physical space for transitional housing and shelter, along with those critical supportive services to help people become stable. Housing infrastructure bonds is a way for providers and nonprofits, tribes, and other institutions to be able to provide this much-needed statewide access. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, you also, and members, you also have a letter in your that's just been distributed to you from Warren Hansen, who's president and CEO of Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, speaking to this. So just a word about the housing infrastructure bonds. We don't know yet where they're going to be. Hopefully in the next week there's more discussion about that. As you heard the former testifier, I can remember when Tanya Orr from Minnesota Housing came to me with this idea that if they could use their bonding authority, it would enable them to have a partnership with nonprofits, Catholic Charities, Lutheran Social Service, Common Bond, Beacon, Aon, and they've leveraged a huge amount of private money for matching the state money and have provided a lot of those services. And so the bill we're hearing today would add housing stabilization as one more use for those housing infrastructure bonds. Ms. Dyson pointed out early in session that that actually housing infrastructure bonds don't have to be in the bonding bill. Because they're an appropriation bond, they don't require a supermajority. So I think there's still some discussion among leadership about where we will go with housing infrastructure bonds this session. So this was for information only today.
And I just get a note about one additional testifier, and I just asked the testifier to be brief since we are short on time, and that's Sue Wetlove Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee Member Sue Wetlove Phillips, MICA, Executive Director of MICA. Just a couple points of information very briefly. So it's important that we utilize all our resources in a very strategic way, and I think that as we're looking at potentially infrastructure being expanded in the different uses, that we need to understand that there are some other resources that we could also use for the development and rehab of shelters and transitional housing, certainly at the local level, community development block grant. In 1994, we passed the transitional housing or temporary housing bill, which included money for rehab of shelters and transitional housing. It was put into the state housing trust fund at that point. We also have federal emergency shelter grants, now called emergency solution grants, from the federal level that are also specifically for developing structures. So as we're looking at additional things that we're doing in infrastructure, we need to look at increasing the amount of money that we have in the bonding area. We need to also look at potentially manufactured homes. I know Senator Dietzick is also looking at tiny homes also on the Senate side. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And my 30-second comment would be just generally, I think this is our issue with unsheltered homelessness is emerging. It's urgent. We need to address it. And when you look at the overall challenges, it's an issue where we need to figure out ways to grow the pie, not necessarily, pit other needs and challenges against each other. That's what this issue tells me. So. Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. Specifically to that point about the appropriation bond, I know appropriation bonds tend to be a little bit more in interest and the value that we get for that then can actually be reduced. But is that the only way we do this type of bonding work anyway, is simply appropriation, so it wouldn't matter whether we're appropriating it or the Capital Investment Committee's appropriating it?
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Pearson, if your question is about the use of the bond proceeds, general obligation bond proceeds can only be used for publicly owned buildings and land. So the housing infrastructure bonds allow the bond proceeds to go directly to nonprofits without that public ownership in between. But I don't know if that was your question.
It was exactly what I was asking, but far more eloquently stated, so I appreciate your clarity. And so, again, I think it emphasizes the chair's point, then, of this not having to go through the capital investment. There's no financial benefit for that, then, either, is what I'm hearing.
Representative Hausman, any final words?
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for your vote on House File 1151 this morning. That, I understand, will be up in Ways and Means next Wednesday, a week from today. And so that's why we're still thinking through some of the, specifically the issue of housing infrastructure bonds and where they finally land. I will just quote from Homes for All, where we live impacts every aspect of our lives, the jobs we can access, the education our children receive, and the well-being of our growing senior population. And as we heard those research reports at the beginning of our meeting, I will say that growing senior population is almost terrifying when you think about the impact in just 10 years from now.
Thank you, Chair Hausman. And with that, we are adjourned.